On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
But what about the promise
to build the wall and make Mexico pay for it? What about the promise?
There's no longer an onus for the candidates to take substantive stands.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Great anger many American voters are feeling.
But there is a real anger.
The American people are angry.
Voters are angry across the board.
4 in 10 voters said they are angry.
They have anger that's unbelievable.
People are angry.
There is a great anger out there.
I am angry. And the American people are angry.
Okay, there's a consensus. Voters are angry. Well, one way to channel anger is by attending political rallies and demonstrating enthusiastic support for presidential candidates. On that front, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are cleaning up, attracting record-breaking crowds at rallies across the country. Yesterday in Manhattan, Sanders attracted a crowd of more than 25,000 people to Clinton's much smaller rally of around 1,300. Tonight, the two will debate in Brooklyn. It's their last televised debate before New York's primary on Tuesday. Despite the tremendous enthusiasm both Trump and Sanders enjoy, it may not be enough, though, to secure their party's nominations. So what will their supporters do if their preferred candidate doesn't win? Does the movement dissipate? Joining me now to talk about that is Jason Johnson, a political scientist and politics editor at TheRoot.com. Hi there.
Hi, glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Well, so the voters are angry. Whose voters are angriest?
I would say Trump's voters are angriest because they've been angry a long time. They were angry before Donald Trump. They will be angry after Donald Trump is out of the race. They are pretty much driven by a level of frustration, anxiety and anger about the entire electoral process. And this is just their latest way of expressing that frustration.
Okay. So what happens, though, if there is a fight at the convention, if on the second or third vote he is denied the nomination, what happens to these voters?
I think it's simplistic to say they're going to be angry, but you have to also look at where that anger comes from. A lot of the supporters of Donald Trump are also disengaged voters. There was a recent study just came out with The Atlantic, talks about the fact that they're less likely to go to church, less likely to be part of civic groups, less likely to be part of clubs, less likely to vote in general. So these are people who, if Trump ends up being, in my opinion, cheated out of this nomination, they're likely to complain and scream, and there may be some physical violence and altercations, low-level rioting in Cleveland, but they're just going to stay home. These are not the kinds of people that get together and put together organizations to sustain a movement. And so if Trump is not on this ticket, those Republicans are not going to participate in this fall's election.
They're not going to vote, you're saying?
They're not going to vote, and they're not going to do anything but go home and be angry and fill up the comment sections on liberal websites.
But why do you say that when we saw the Tea Party rise after the last presidential election, and they were pretty politically effective? You could argue that John Boehner no longer has his job because of them.
Well, a couple of things happened with the Tea Party. One, the Tea Party had a lot of money, and it was actually built on a particular set of events and principles that those voters could sustain and continue to talk about. The Tea Party sort of came into being because of voter anger about the bailout of the banks. And then it was extended by things that had to do with the stimulus package. And then it was exacerbated by the fact that an African-American got elected president of the United States. There were things to keep the organization going. And then you had large numbers of right-wing PACs and organizations that were funding this at the grassroots. That's not what you have with Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not a movement. Donald Trump is barely a member of the Republican Party. He doesn't even have the ground networks of, say, the Reform Party did by the 1996 presidential election when Ross Perot ran a second time. So I don't think there's even an infrastructure in place for Trump supporters to become anything other than disembodied, disenfranchised, angry voters if he doesn't end up being the party's nominee.
But then do they come back 4 years, 8 years from now in the guise of another candidate?
Well, I think it depends. And that's a really good question, because a lot of this is going to have to do with how, if Hillary Clinton wins the presidential election, and I would bet rent money on that. I think if it's her against Donald Trump, I think it's a situation where America, hashtag hold your nose for Hillary. Unhappy liberals will vote for Hillary. Unhappy Republicans will stay home. Some of them will vote for Trump. But if this goes down ticket, and if it results in Republicans losing seats in the Senate, if it results in them losing seats in the House, if it results in a across-the-board shellacking, then I think it's highly likely that that section of the Republican Party that supported Donald Trump, I think they might be excised. I think whoever the new leader of the party is after Reince Priebus steps down in January 2017 might say, we need to stop playing footsie with expanding this party. We need to actually go about the process of making it bigger and more inclusive, because we can't win presidential elections this way anymore, focusing primarily on working and middle class angry white voters in the South.
Okay, let's turn to the Democrats, because there are angry white voters on that side as well,
yes.
primarily in the Bernie camp. And just yesterday at this rally in New York, there was a guy from Santa Monica, an oncologist, his name is Paul Song, and he basically said something that the Bernie campaign is now disavowing. He said, Hillary Clinton is among, and I'm quoting here, corporate Democratic whores. So this indicating that there is a level of frustration and anger there, because I don't think he's just speaking for himself when he expresses this frustration and anger at the mainstream arm of the Democratic Party. What happens to those voters who are very politically engaged, at least at this moment?
Well, here's the thing, and I don't mean to sort of be cynical when I say this, but we don't have a lot of history. Certainly, I'm a Gen Xer, right? There's not a lot of history of young voters and Gen Xers putting together sustainable movements of the last 16 or 17 years outside of Black Lives Matter. Occupy Wall Street lasted about a year and a half, and then it disappeared. The Tea Party lasted maybe two election cycles before they were absorbed into the Republican Party. And so history doesn't say, or history doesn't suggest, that when Hillary Clinton, or if Hillary Clinton wins the nomination, that Sanders voters are going to break off on their own, that they're going to form a third party, that they're going to create a sustainable movement. They'll be unhappy. But as of right now, there hasn't been any movement within the Sanders support group to create something like PUMA. In 2008, you had a group that came together and they called themselves Party Unity My A. And these were Hillary Clinton supporters who said, I don't care what happens. I'm never going to vote for this Senator Obama guy. And he still won. And polls show that the vast majority of those people came back. So if they were willing to form an organization to show their disdain for Senator Obama at the time, and they still came around, I don't see any reason why Sanders supporters will not end up doing the same thing at some point this fall.
Do they stay home as well, or do they vote in November?
I think they're going to vote, because I believe that internally, and this has to do with sort of the enthusiasm of both people, right? You have a large number of people. As a matter of fact, Bernie Sanders is the most popular guy running for president. I mean, like, these more people like him within his party and nationally than anybody else running right now. And so I think Sanders, when he, or if he loses this nomination, when he goes out and campaigns on behalf of Hillary Clinton, or he speaks well on behalf of Hillary Clinton, that's going to get some of his voters to come out. Like this comment with Song recently, Sanders has made it very clear, whenever somebody in his camp says something inappropriate or sexist or problematic about Hillary Clinton, he's right out there saying, that's not what this campaign is about. And I think that's going to roll over to having his supporters come and help him. If Donald Trump ended up not getting this nomination, he will tell his supporters to stay home or tear this party from top to bottom. So I think it also has to do with the personalities of the men leading these movements as well.
Jason Johnson, politics editor at TheRoot.com. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Anytime.
Well, we'd love to hear from you. If you are a Trump or Sanders supporter, what will you do if your candidate does not appear on the November ballot? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Well, there's growing anger in Los Angeles. It's over development. Should we grow taller and denser or not? On the no side, angry residents and activists who say developers have been given carte blanche to make up their own rules. A group of them have written a ballot proposal for next March that would stop all big developments for 2 years. On the yes side, more angry residents and activists, as well as city officials like Mayor Eric Garcetti. Garcetti pushing back. Yesterday, he announced that he'll hire 28 city planners to update LA's very old development guidelines. New rules would presumably mean fewer exceptions for real estate developers. But will they do anything to cool this debate? And why can't we all get on the same page about the future of our city and what it should look like? Zev Yaroslavsky is director of the LA Initiative at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. He's also a former Los Angeles County supervisor and a former LA City Councilman. So he knows the inner workings quite well. Hi, Zev.
Good afternoon.
Well, Garcetti's new announcement is that he's going to update LA's 35 so-called community plans. And these are basically development blueprints, I believe, for different neighborhoods, how tall buildings can be, how many units they can have, et cetera. What's wrong with these plans now? Why do they need to be updated?
Well, the plans are old, and some of them are 25, 30 years old and haven't been updated. The world has changed in the last 30 years, and plans really should be updated every 5 years. And if there was a system by which to do it, it wouldn't require this kind of major overhaul. But it's not the plans alone that are the problem. The problem is that the city doesn't even abide by its own plans, and that's the perception that people have, and frankly, with some justification. You have the ground zero for this debate has been in Hollywood. 30 years ago, it was in Westwood and Encino and Brentwood, which spawned a citizens' initiative that my late colleague Marvin Browdy and I put on the ballot in 1986. It passed by almost 70% of the vote, Proposition U. And I've been warning for many years now that unless the city got serious about enforcing their plans and not allowing every developer or any developer, frankly, who comes into the city and says, I need to increase the density allowable on my property, I need to increase the height, I need to reduce the amount of parking required, unless they stop giving that stuff away, that there would be another revolution. And and this initiative that's now being circulated is giving voice to those people all over the city. It's not just Hollywood, and it's not just West Side. It's San Pedro. It's Chatsworth and Granada Hills and Sylmar and Boyle Heights, where there's a gentrification epidemic going on that's concerning many of the residents there. People are concerned about respecting the character of their neighborhoods. Now, there are plenty of places in Los Angeles which are appropriate and already have density and are appropriate for even more density, and you don't need a plan change or a zone change to do it. There's capacity for growing the housing stock in the city by almost 1 million units without a single zone change. But developers aren't doing that. They're not building where they are allowed to build. They buy a piece of property, very often paying much more than the property is worth, and then they go to the city and say, I can't make ends meet. I can't get my return on investment unless you increase my density. And I've seen that in my own neighborhood where somebody bought a piece of property for nearly twice of what it was worth and then went to the city and said, please double my density so that I can make a profit.
Right, because they want to build in desirable neighborhoods. They don't want to build in neighborhoods that are, you know, up and coming.
Well,
so to speak,
in part that's true, but not exclusively. I don't want to characterize any neighborhood in Los Angeles as being desirable or undesirable, but there's been a lot of development in areas which historically have been viewed as undesirable, more towards the central part of the city, west of downtown, east of Hancock Park. Hollywood itself in the eastern part of Hollywood has been anemic for a half a century and now is exploding with growth. So it's not so much desirable or undesirable neighborhoods, it's where does a developer, and the developers are not evil people. They are trying to make a living. They are investing a lot of money, and they want to make a return on their investment, just like you or I would. So they come into an area, they overpay because the reputation of the city is, and has been for some time, it's not this mayor or this city council, it has been for some time, Gail Goldberg, the former planning director of the city, made the following statement. He says, in most cities in America, the value of a piece of property is determined by what the zoning is. In Los Angeles, it's determined by what the developer thinks he can get the zoning to be.
Hmm.
And so it becomes almost like an auction, and that's not a good thing.
So do you think that this plan that Garcetti has put forth would change that, put a stop to that, or just be more of the same?
It all depends on how it turns out. You know, there are some people that were quoted in the paper this morning who are concerned that a redo of all these plans may result in massive upzoning. I mean, once it's like a constitutional convention. Once you open up the Constitution or once you open up the master plan of the city or the city's general plan, it could go in any number of directions. I think it's a good thing. I think that the city council and the mayor, you know, ought to be upfront about it and say, you know, this is a response to the initiative that's been circulated, because there's been this bubbling up of this revolution going on in various parts of the city. The key is what's the end product? So there are places that are appropriate for more intense development, and there are places which are not appropriate for it. There are more density needs to be coupled with neighborhood preservation and neighborhood protection. You can't make it look like Sao Paulo, Brazil, or Houston, Texas, where you can build anything anywhere. And so you don't want to build high-rise buildings that cast permanent shadows over people's homes or condominiums or apartments. And you need to be sensitive about gentrification and the implications it has for moving people who are on the margins of the economy out of the city completely or onto the streets. You do want to build more housing, but luxury housing is not going to solve the homeless problem. That's a trickle-down philosophy, which I've never subscribed to. That needs to be addressed directly with the building of affordable housing.
Do you think that this what's going on in Hollywood with these developments, the Millennium and all that, do you think that is just...
It's going on all over the city.
But is that like a fig leaf? I mean, people say, oh, that's going to create more housing, but you think it's just going to create...
Well, the argument that's been used against controlling, you know, and rigorously controlling and being selective about where you allow density has been, you got to allow people to build housing because it's going to solve the homeless problem. Well, the buildings that are being built in Hollywood that are the most objectionable aren't housing projects, they're commercial projects. And those that are housing projects are luxury housing projects. So let's quit the BS and be straight with people. There are places in LA which are appropriate for denser development, and they ought to be facilitated, but they ought to be done in moderation. It should not be take it all. You know, developers can't be overly ambitious or greedy, and residents need to be partners in this struggle. But the bottom line is this, Madeline. Everybody wants certainty. Okay? A developer wants to know. Usually, a developer wants to know, tell me what I can build, and I'll go build it. But don't make it uncertain, because then my economic model falls apart. And residents want to know, when I buy a home or when I buy or rent an apartment or buy a condominium, I want to know that you can't, in 2 days, you're not going to grant a permit for a 30-story skyscraper that blocks my view or that blocks my access to the sun and destroys my investment in solar energy that I made and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you can have both. And that... It's not easy, and it makes it more difficult on developers. It makes it more difficult on residents, frankly. But there needs to be this is not a NIMBY issue. This is a partnership issue. And the perception in the city today is that the city has not met a development it doesn't love.
We're going to have to leave it there. We will definitely continue this conversation. This debate is not going away soon. Zev Yaroslavsky, director of the LA Initiative at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
All right, what do you think? Should we grow up, out, not at all? Leave us a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why Facebook thinks chatbots are the future and how UC Davis scrubbed unflattering news from the internet. Shani Jardin is here to talk web next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks. Thank you.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Journalist Matthew Keyes has been sentenced to 2 years in prison. He was convicted last year of giving hackers administrative login info for the LA Times. But is the law he broke now out of date? Here to talk about this story and other tech and web news is our regular web contributor, Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net.
Oh, man, Madeline. Yeah, okay, yes,
this story is just getting you in high dudgeon.
My internet outrage buffer is overflowing today. Yesterday afternoon, when the former Reuters social media editor Matthew Keyes got a sentence of 2 years for hacking under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, he didn't even do the hacking according to the complaint.
What did he do?
Keyes used to work for a Fox TV station, and he worked with Reuters and various publications. He had login credentials to Tribune Media from his time at the TV station, and he shared them in a chat group where people identifying themselves as members of the hacking collective Anonymous gathered and shared lulls and picked targets to attack with distributed denial of service attacks mm-hmm. and defacement. So he pasted the login credentials, and some random guy in that channel used them to log into the LA Times content management system and deface a single article. Lord knows how many people were reading the article. It wasn't the front page, although they would have liked to take over the front page and everything else. But it's like spray painting graffiti on a single article for 40 minutes. Then somebody at the paper changed it back. And for this, a man is set to go to prison for 2 years, and they're saying that the LA Times lost like $250,000. And I mean, is the Los Angeles Times even worth $250,000 anymore?
Oh, yowza!
I mean,
he could have been sentenced to 25 years.
That's
apparently.
Right. The federal prosecutors using the same kind of really aggressive pushing the letter of the law to the most all-caps, bold, underlined version of the letter of the law possible. They wanted him, I think at one point they were looking at 72 months in jail. And again, he didn't even do the defacement himself. I want to remind you, yesterday, the so-called affluenza teen murderer killed four people. 1, 2, 3, 4 dead human beings. He also got 2 years in jail.
Not for that even.
Not for that even, for running off to Mexico.
Skipping off, to Mexico.
What is this?
So, couple questions. One is, why was he posting that login in the first place?
It was very bad judgment.
Okay.
It was lulls or, you know, the prosecutors were, I love the line they used. They said, this wasn't a prank. This was rage driven by extreme narcissism. Dude, I do stuff on the internet 95 times a day that's rage driven by extreme narcissism. That's what the internet is. Rage. Driven by extreme narcissism.
That's what our political life is now at this point.
You could say that Matthew Keyes is a little dense. You could even say that maybe he's not really a journalist in the classic sense. You could say all kinds of nasty things about him as an individual. But that's why laws like the CFAA, which also played a key role in the death of Aaron Swartz, the activist hacker, the young man who mm-hmm. died, the Internet's Own Boy, that wonderful film. The CFAA has been at the heart of Aaron's case and of other...
Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Passed in 1986.
1986. Jesus, it's 2016. A lot changes.
So is it true when I Google a New York Times headline, copy and paste it, let's say, in a Google search, to maybe get around...
To evade
paying,
the paywall.
Yeah, for the article. Not saying I do that, but if one does that, is that a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act?
Madeline Brand, you're a hacker. Go directly to jail. Yes.
Really?
So the point of badly written laws, kind of like the anti-encryption bill that we're talking about today mm-hmm. In the news, badly written laws can be used to send people to prison over crimes that just... where it just doesn't make sense. Maybe
it seems like when it was written in 86, people were a lot more fearful of what was happening, or they didn't understand it.
That law emerged during a kind of hacker panic, kind of like the satanic panic around the same time.
Yeah.
People, come on, 1986, the internet didn't really start being a thing for most people until way later. But the idea was that computer networks could, we've always had this fear of the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And now you know, I'm sorry, but 40 minutes of a defacement of an article that may or may not have even had anything interesting in it to begin with? Come on.
Okay, so he may appeal. Mark Zuckerberg announced that Facebook wants developers to create bots for its Messenger app.
Chat bots. Why didn't they call
it a FaceBot?
Or a Zuckerbot.
That sounds better.
I like a Zuckerbot.
What is this?
Natural language processing. So the idea is that you could log on to Facebook and chat up, I think some of the early launch partners included CNN, Burger King. So you could say, ask the CNN bot, what's going on today with ISIS? And the CNN bot might act as your kind of your internet producer and say, are you interested in learning about the refugee crisis or about the chemical weapons stash we found last night?
Mm.
And it's also a platform.
Is this typed or voice recognition?
You can do both, depending on how you use Facebook Messenger. And the app, like everything else on Facebook, is also about serving you ads. It seems to me like Google, Apple, Facebook, each of these really, really large companies that has its hands in various pots, network delivery, hardware, software, various web services, social networks, they're all kind of improvising to some extent, but trying to create the largest ecosystem that they can to keep you involved all the time in their ecosystem. And I think Facebook is trying to do that here. It's interesting to note that the big announcement wasn't just that the chatbots were available, but that this was a platform that third parties, media, restaurants, clothing, whatever, could use to engage with you and your credit card.
A couple of years ago, the web went crazy with videos of UC Davis police pepper spraying protesters. I think they were Occupy protesters. And now it's been revealed that the university paid about $175,000 to scrub references to that pepper spraying incident on the internet.
UC Davis paid $175,000 or more to so-called reputation management firms to basically claw. They do this like reverse SEO. It's not magic. It involves a lot of emailing to publishers. For instance, like Boing Boing, we get these requests all the time. My client was caught running around in his underwear on live TV, impersonating Super Mario from the video game 10 years ago. You have an item on your blog. Would you please take it down? He has a wife and family and can't get employed.
Do you take it down?
Often. The pepper spraying incident, we would not. It's an item of news. You don't just remove news.
Right.
We have a phrase on the internet. It's called the Streisand effect. You ever heard of that?
No. What is that?
Barbara Streisand once tried to do this with photos of her property up the coast here. And those photos ended up proliferating tenfold, a hundredfold, because everybody wanted to know what Barbara Streisand wanted to keep secret. And that's what's happening in this case, too. Because UC Davis used this money, it's a school. It's a state school.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they spending $175,000 to try to make you forget something really bad that happened there? Because of that, I think this story will never go away.
In fact, I just typed in UC Davis in a Google search. The second item here is UC Davis tried really, really hard to erase that 2001 pepper spray incident from the internet. So
they could have saved themselves $175,000 by Googling the phrase Streisand effect. That is my advice for the day. For anybody who would like to make the internet forget anything, forget about it.
Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, well, about scrubbing things from the internet, what happens when a troll ruins your online identity?
More and more our online identities impact our identities offline and our identities in our daily lives. And yet you have very, very little control over your online identity, as it turns out.
Business reporter is relentlessly harassed by a guy she did a story on. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Bloomberg journalist Dune Lawrence covers the nitty-gritty financial details of Chinese business dealings here in the United States. Not exactly the kinds of stories that usually inspire heated online debate. But while writing about a company called AgFeed back in 2013, Dune Lawrence became the target of an all-out online trolling campaign by a guy named Benjamin Wei. Lawrence mentioned Wei's name in the AgFeed story. He had worked with the company as a consultant at some point. Her story never implicated him in any wrongdoing, but it kicked off a two-year trolling spree in which Wei claimed on his website, The Blot, that Lawrence was racist, that she had been kicked out of China for being a bad reporter, that she was deeply addicted to Kentucky Fried Chicken. Really. For Bloomberg Businessweek, Dune Lawrence recently wrote about her two-year odyssey of trying to get Wei's online attacks taken down. And her first inclination that something was up, a weird email in 2014, and here's what it said.
We are preparing a series of investigative articles on short sellers and their illegal campaign against Chinese companies and your involvement with them. Just this list of questions. A lot of them framed in this way, sort of like, sources say you were kicked out of China for poor job performance and that you were scarred and that you're a racist against all Chinese people. Like, do you have a comment? You know, it's sort of, it's obviously not the way I would phrase questions when I'm sending them to sources. So,
right.
I mean, I knew that it was, you know, he didn't really want to hear my side of the story or wasn't really reporting something. He was just making stuff up.
So when you got that email, did you think, oh, this is just a crank. I'm not going to respond to this email. This is ridiculous.
You might be surprised to hear that I don't get emails like that all the time. And it was disturbing because it felt to me very menacing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know what he meant to do with it. So as one does, I mean, I sort of consulted with my editors and lawyers and stuff, and I didn't respond. But then he kept on sending these emails. He sent at least a couple more before the story came out. And
the story you say in quotes.
The story, right, the article about me came out.
And this was in this website, The Blot.
Yeah, exactly. And please don't Google it, but it's outrageous. It's, you know, you wouldn't read it and think, oh, this is an objective news article about, I mean, it's definitely an attack. It's very personal. It's very insulting. I mean, there's nothing professional or normal about the tone. So in that sense, it's kind of like, do I take this really seriously? I mean, it's obviously defamatory, but how much do I need to respond? And I guess the most upsetting thing, and it were the Google results. You know, I'm a journalist and I have to contact people for stories. Most of the time, people who have no idea who I am. So what's the normal reaction that they're going to have when I contact them and email them and or leave them a voicemail saying, this is Dune Lawrence? First of all, they're going to be like, Dune Lawrence, what is that name? They're going to Google me.
Right.
And the first thing that comes up or one of the first things that come up is this article about how I'm even just the headline and a picture of me with the racist over it. Even if you don't believe all the allegations in it, it just makes you feel gross to look at it.
So why did you decide that you needed to write an article about this and actually kind of turn the tables?
Well, you know, I didn't want to poke the beast, really. It's kind of like, okay, my Google results have this thing, but is it really worth a hailstorm of ugly responses to try and deal with this more head on? I thought it would go away. And then, you know, there kept on being this more and more outrageous elements of the story, like this poor Swedish woman who had worked for him briefly and then ended up suing him for sexual harassment because he, you know, booked them one hotel room on their trips and then basically put a lot of pressure on her. And then when she ended the relationship that they eventually had, he fired her. So she sues and then she wins. Last summer, she wins an $18 million judgment against him for sexual harassment and defamation. And the stories about her are still up online. All these stories that The Blot has put out about how she's a coke addict and a drunk and just totally crazy things that have harmed her reputation irreparably. You know, even though she's won this huge amount of money against him, they're all still up.
Why didn't you ever sue him for defamation?
Well, I've always thought of it as a sort of, I haven't sued him yet.
Oh.
I sort of put it off because I just found it very distracting. It was hard to work. It was hard to do anything. And it provoked a lot of anxiety in me. And I mean, if you look at what has happened to the people who have sued him, it's so unpleasant. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just, it goes on forever. I mean, this another example is someone who sued him directly for defamation over the blot posts. And it's this, I mentioned him in the story. He's a professor at Georgetown Law. And the professor sues Wei in April 2015. And then it's taken until now to even establish that the case can go forward. And it's been bruising. You know, this guy is suing, he's spending all this money, and there's constantly more stuff going up on the blot or being reposted, calling him a fraud and an Uncle Tom and alleging he, you know, has cheated on his wife. And I don't know. It's just the whole thing is,
it's
really ugly. And I think that's what happens when you respond. Unfortunately, it gets even uglier.
Yeah. Aside from it being irritating and juvenile and also causing you a lot of anxiety, have there been any real world consequences for you, for your career, for your life, anything like that?
You know, I can't prove definitively that this was specifically related to the blot, but I can't imagine what else it would be, which is, you know, we were trying to get new homeowners insurance, my husband and I, and we'd gone through the process. You know, there's sort of this back and forth. And then at the last minute, they came back and told my husband that they couldn't issue us the policy because I was a high profile person. And I mean, I don't know how I count as high profile, other than the fact that now there's all these attack articles dedicated to me.
So are you worried at all that this will never end? I mean, it seems the point of your article, or at least one of the points of your article, is how difficult it is to recover your online reputation if someone is bent on destroying it.
Well, that's the point that I want to be the takeaway. It's not that I am some horrible victim. I mean, obviously, other people have had a much more difficult time with him. But more to talk about my process of education in understanding, you know, what your options are. And you don't have a lot of recourse. And I think it's an issue for our age. More and more of our lives are lived online, and more and more our online identities impact our identities offline and our identities in our daily lives. And yet you have very, very little control over your online identity, as it turns out.
Well, Dune, thanks for sharing your story with us today.
Well, thank you.
That's Dune Lawrence. She wrote an article for Bloomberg Businessweek called "The Journalist and the Troll: This Man Spent 2 Years Trying to Destroy Me Online." Dune, I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up on this program, how we listen to music has changed. So has finding new music for professional curators, i.e. DJs. KCRW's Anthony Valadez is here to talk about his musical discoveries online.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The website SoundCloud recently announced it's starting its own music subscription service, joining a field already crowded with sites like Spotify, Pandora, Apple. But SoundCloud has something none of the other music streaming services has. It has millions of recordings and remixes and DJ sets posted by its users. In the digital world, anyone who makes music can share it online. We've heard about how that's complicating life for labels and even artists themselves who can have a hard time getting paid for their music. But what about radio DJs? How do they deal with the mountain of new music constantly being uploaded and shared? Well, Anthony Valadez is a DJ here at KCRW, and he has lived through this transition. He's living through it now. Loving it.
Maintaining. Non-stop music.
You're like an octopus with all your arms.
That's
a deal.
Exactly how I feel.
Right. Okay. So it used to be that you DJs would just get records from labels, right?
Correct.
And that's how you would find out about new music?
Correct.
Now what do you do?
Well, I like to dig through blogs. The blogosphere is incredible in terms of finding new music. You know, when I was a kid, you would look through magazines, you go to record stores, and I miss that culture. But now, I don't have a lot of time. So now I like to check out digital platforms like Tidal, Spotify, and SoundCloud. And I like to dig and see what's happening there. And that's where I find, I would say, a large portion of the music that I play on my show, in addition to vinyl and CDs. I'm still a traditionalist.
You are.
I am. I love record stores.
Yeah. But you don't get the records from the labels themselves necessarily.
I do. But you know what? Record labels, they want to save money. They cut costs. So now they send me MP3s.
Okay. And I know she'll be the death of me. At least we'll both be numb. And she'll always get the best of me. The worst is yet to come. But at least we'll both be beautiful and stay forever young. This I know. Okay, so you, I understand, discovered an artist who is now huge, and you discovered him online, SoundCloud?
I did. I didn't discover him. Like, I played him, and now he's a celebrity. But, I mean, that did happen. His name is The Weeknd, for those who don't know. He's got, like, a huge radio song. It's, like, number one.
Can't feel my face.
I can feel my face when I'm with you.
There it is.
But I love it. But I love it.
But back in the day, he had this interesting strategy where he gave out a couple of his albums out for free. And that was something that was unheard of. Like, why would you give this out, considering the amount of time and money that went into this project? But it was a great way to, here's my music, take a listen, and if you love it, support me down the road. And there was something about his sound that was exotic. It was sexy. And being on at midnight, it was like a no-brainer to play it.
Does it touch you like this?
And now he's all over the place. And if you want to buy that song, you now have to purchase it.
Really?
Yeah, it's on iTunes.
Well, he
now
has to make some money. Right?
Of course. But as a label, like, would you really want to sign somebody who gave away all that music for free? It's interesting times that we live in.
So tell us about a song that you discovered from him.
Well, What You Need is very sexy, melodic, mellow. And being on Monday nights from 12 to 3 on KCRW, plug, I like that kind of vibe. And this song definitely exemplifies the vibe of what I love in music today.
I'm the drug in your pain. Just fighting through the pain. He's what you want. He's what you want. He's what you want. He's what you want. I'm what you need. What you need. What you need. I'm what you need. What you need. What you need. He's what you want. He's what you want. He's what you want. He's what you want.
The Weeknd with his song, What You Need. Yeah, that's right. Pretty hot.
But think about it. I mean, he can take chances when he's not on a label and putting music out for free.
Right.
Whereas when you're on a major label, you have to listen to maybe hundreds of people for thumbs up and approval and budgeting and all these things that have to be taken into consideration when it comes to releasing an album.
What about being a DJ, being you? And you don't necessarily have to be at KCRW, although yay, you're here. This is a great radio station.
Dream come true.
Dream come true. But you could just do your own stuff online.
I do.
You do?
I do.
I'm moonlighting elsewhere?
Well, I host a podcast on NTS Radio, which is out of London. I do a radio show on Dash Radio every Tuesday nights.
Yo, what's good? It's Anthony Valadez. This is Mood Swings on Dash Radio. It's a Tuesday night. Just got in here, and I've got lots of music to play.
So it allows me to try different things. And what I love about these online platforms is that it's almost a return to cable access. There's no right or wrong. And I love the adventure. I love that everything you were taught in radio can go out the window, especially in podcasts. I mean, I listen to podcasts where guys don't even know where it's going and they're just talking about food and somebody's eating a grilled cheese sandwich during a podcast. I love that because it's real. It's two people just talking about food.
Right. So what can you do playing music there online that, let's say, you couldn't do on KCRW?
Well, profanity. Not that I play music of profanity, but it's just kind of nice to let your guard down and not worry about the FCC. Maybe I want to do a quick mix. Maybe I want to play the entire Black Sabbath record or something. Like, I can do whatever I want.
Right. What about payment? Who's getting paid in all this?
Well, I would say that these are passion projects. Uh-huh. There's no money, but it allows me to engage with an audience, especially utilizing social media. When I'm on air, whether it's at KCRW or Dash Radio or NTS, I'm talking to my listeners, and it's somewhat of a business card. And I've had a lot of folks hire me strictly because of my podcast or because of my radio show on Dash or KCRW. It allows me to connect in a way that's very much non-traditional in real time.
And then you can also make music, right? You're not just playing music, but you can also do remixes.
Oh, okay. So SoundCloud is a great example. It's a platform that one time allowed a lot of DJs and remixers to post music up. Maybe there's a hot song by, let's say, Bruno Mars. And you have the vocals, and you can play with the instrumentation, you can give it a different feel, and you can post it to SoundCloud. Yeah, you make me feel like I've been locked out of heaven. Now, maybe last year, before it got all strict, you would acquire likes, and people would share that. Blogs would post that, and somehow that would go viral. It would gain traction. But now that's stopped. Now SoundCloud, because of royalties, you shouldn't be able to build your reputation and make money without that artist getting anything. So eventually.
But wasn't that the whole legal battle that was fought when hip hop came up?
I mean, samples.
Like a generation ago.
But eventually producers in hip hop had to pay up.
Yeah.
So you heard less and less sampling.
Right.
So the same thing with SoundCloud. Now they want you to pay up. So what's happening as we speak is this new platform in which SoundCloud teamed up, I believe, with Sony. And you have to pay a $10 subscription fee. So now I guess they are allowing these remixes, but you have to pay to stream it. And the money goes to these artists. So
that's a good thing for the artists.
It's a good thing for everybody. We live in a very interesting time of technology and music. This collision is very interesting. TBD, as I say, to be determined.
Well, speaking of collision, I want to play some music from an artist. He's Haitian-Canadian. His name is Catronata. So tell us a little bit about him and then we'll listen.
He's somebody that I came across on SoundCloud. Another cool feature on SoundCloud is if somebody you follow can recommend things, you can repost some of their music and it shows up in your feed. It's kind of like Twitter with music. And so this guy constantly kept popping up in my feed and I would listen and he would do these incredible remixes of old music from the 90s, a lot of 90s R&B soul. And he just puts this interesting flair on it, his own signature. And it's kind of lo-fi, filtery dance music. And I would, you know, grab that, play it in the clubs that night.
That's Catronata, Haitian-Canadian artist.
Now Catronata is playing at all the big festivals across the world. So it's interesting. He hasn't even put out an album yet. He has an album dropping, but because of SoundCloud, he's touring festivals and he's able to make an income. So interesting note.
Interesting. Okay, so that's Catronata. And you also want to talk about Soulection. Why do you want to talk about Soulection? And what is it?
Well, Soulection is a group of young music curators who I discovered on SoundCloud. And originally they had a show on a college campus. And I was a guest on that show many, many moons ago. And, you know, good heart, kid. Keep it up. And now they have a show on Beats One, you know, the Apple's music radio show. And it's so great to see them grow. And they developed this community utilizing SoundCloud, utilizing Instagram, utilizing various different apps. And so with like photography apps, so they incorporated photography and music and they would do meetups where people who loved their sound would meet up and say, hey, you're so-and-so, you post under that name. Great to meet you. So they brought this digital element to a physical form and now they sell out shows across the world, which is amazing.
Future Beats, eclectic soul, forgotten gem. Thomas, all brought to you by Joe K. This is Soulection Radio on Beats One.
Yeah.
So we could listen to them on Beats One. How else do we catch them?
SoundCloud. Or you could check them out on Twitter, and you could find out where they're performing. And it's fun because a lot of the music that they play, it's a lot of remixes, a lot of original production made by a lot of their artists who basically met because of the internet.
All right. Should we be worried, we who work in traditional terrestrial radio, should we be worried that all the youngins are going to SoundCloud and the internet and they'll never come back?
Not at all. I think we're good. However, I feel like we can take a page from their book, from their playbook. I love how the passion is there. When I listen to these kids who love music and make musical discoveries via the internet, you can hear the excitement in their voice. And I love that. The realness, you know, the realness.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, let's go out with one of your remixes.
Okay, this is a remix that I did on SoundCloud, and eventually LA band Local Natives heard it, and they posted it on their SoundCloud. So they were able to co-sign the remix that I did unofficially, which is the beauty of the internet.
Well, Anthony Valadez, it's been so great to have you here in the daylight hours. It's so great to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Monday nights, midnight to 3.
All right. You heard it here first.
In Japan, I love it all. So much I call.
Okay, that tune is called Airplanes. Hi, Julie Myers.
Hi. I just kind of want to listen to this song.
Oh, we're just bopping out in here, rocking out, dancing along.
So, feedback style, feedback remix here.
Yeah.
That is about what I can do.
We need Anthony to remix.
That's why I'm
your
theme. The news side of all of this. Well, where do you catch your music besides KCRW? Because I know you all are listening to Morning Becomes Eclectic and all of that.
And Anthony Valadez.
Exactly. Mondays at midnight. That's another plug. Where do you find your digital music? Hit us up.
Okay.
Facebook.
Done.
Or Twitter. Do it to it.
At KCRW Press Play, Julie Myers. Thank you very much, and thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.